Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. I'm delighted to have back as my guest for the second time today, David Fulmer. Today we'll be discussing the Dying Crapshooters Blues, published by Harcourt. First of all, David, thanks so much for taking time out of a busy schedule to join us today.
Thank you for having me back again.
David, first of all, I'd like to let the listeners know that Rampart Street is now available in a very nice trade paperback and by Harvest Books. And I really enjoyed Rampart Street. And when I saw the Dying Crapshooters Blues, I loved the dust jacket again. And I said, boy, this guy gets good dust jackets and good titles.
The titles, I'll take the credit for it. The jackets are totally Harcourt's art department, and they do a fabulous job, and I've been completely thrilled with every cover they've done so far with books. And I, as I told you before, sometimes I'm just so overwhelmed by how strong the covers are that I get a little bit concerned that the book's not going to be the equal of the cover.
Well, The Dying Crapshooters Blues is your fourth novel, and the first thing that I noticed as I started reading it is that this novel takes place in Atlanta in the 1920s, which I found very fascinating because Storyville had been an area that you had carved out in your first three novels. And tell us, if you would, how The Dying Crapshooters Blues in Atlanta forged themselves into your creativity.
Well, I'm interested in these times and places historically that seem to be really good stages for a story. Storyville is an example of one of them, and there's, you know, selected others over the 20th century. Atlanta was one in the 20s. There was a lot going on. I live in Atlanta. So there was a lot going on here in the 1920s in terms of music, in terms of you know, social change. The urbanization was in full flush, and the city was growing really fast. There was lots of corruption. There were also, of course, all the attendant racial issues that go with that. So it was a really intriguing stage for me. Now, you're right, I had done the three Storyville books, and when it came time to do a new contract, I basically asked Harcourt if I could have a break and do something else, and they agreed. So I'm doing this Atlanta book, and then I'll be back to Storyville for the next two books.
Oh, okay, good. Well, I found it very interesting because Atlanta is such a huge city now, and one of the things I like most about your writing is, and we talked about this last time, is when you're doing research into an era, it's very difficult to determine what parts of the research you put into the story and what you leave out, because there was so much going on in Atlanta in the 20s, and the whole distinction of racism, like there was just the kind of fact that you get that in the police department, two-thirds of the Atlanta Police Department were members of the Ku Klux Klan.
Correct. Yeah, it's, you know, I really go for, I guess what we call the common history. And while I do the general research on the political cross-currents and the social cross-currents and things like that, no matter what I'm researching, I always go to the newspaper files, because you find out what's going on down on the street, down on the ground, and it also gives me some clues into how people spoke at the time, kind of the language they used, and the little details that you don't necessarily find in a big thick history book, you can find just by reading a newspaper from 1923. You find these little curious stories, and you really get a much better sense of the day-to-day life in the city at that time, and that's what I'm interested in.
Mm-hmm. And Atlanta is in some areas of the South are areas of great wealth, and in the Dying Crapshooters Blues, one of the what kind of kickstarts a story is a a robbery in the Payne mansion, and Mrs. Payne discovers her zebra wood jewelry box has been ransacked. And I found it kind of very interesting, the social caste system that you write about. A lot of it had to do with the color of your skin, but a lot of it had to do with a lot of accumulated wealth as well.
Exactly. And that the part of town that you describe is called Inman Park, and the centerpiece of Inman Park is the Candler Mansion, and that's the Candler who was the driving force behind Coca-Cola. He's the one that bought the recipe for Coca-Cola from the Atlanta pharmacist, and so he was, you know, one of the wealthiest people in the city and in the southeast. That's the neighborhood where this all takes place. And like a lot of other cities, Inman Park was the first suburb, you know, of the downtown, though it's only a few miles away. And it was a way for rich people to get out of the center of the city. And it was made possible by small gauge railroads that their help could get out of the city to these mansions. And it still is in Atlanta a section of just marvelous old Victorian homes. But it was definitely at that time, it was off limits to anyone of color.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it seems that the police department was very much took care of this segment of the population. There's an excellent character, the captain, who
yeah, you know, that was very much a kind of a throwback when you think about these cities. Even though we did live in a democracy, there was still sort of the leftover old system from even going as far back as the Middle Ages, where the police were there basically to protect the lives and the property of the well-to-do, and the people on the bottom rungs of society were pretty much left to their own devices to, you know, do whatever they wanted, to kill each other. And you've seen this. Gangs of New York is a perfect example of that. When the police did deal with the lower strata of society, it was either in a completely violent and oppressive way, or it was completely corrupt. And that system stayed in place into the 30s, and then it began to change. Probably with the Second World War, the real age of democracy came along, and the police were expected to protect all of society. But at that time, the police were, for the most part, and especially at that time in Atlanta, were very much an arm of what you might call polite society.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The private army, so to speak.
Sure. And the Dying Crapshooter's Blues is actually it's a song, and
mm-hmm.
like the Storyville novels you've written, music plays an integral part in the novel. And I love what you do with the music, Little Jesse Williams.
Mm-hmm.
And
you know, Casey, that one of the things that always drove me nuts was authors who used song titles that really had nothing to do with the contents of the book, just because the song titles are so cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they are. And but in this case, I have always been a big fan of Blind Willie McTell, and I came across his recording that was done here in Atlanta in 1956, when he talks about the creation of this song, The Dying Crapshooter's Blues.
Hmm.
Now, to take a step back, that song, you know, music fans will notice that it's got somewhat of a familiar structure, chord structure, and that song goes all the way back to about 300 years to a song called The Unfortunate Rake that was first, you know, written down in Ireland in the 17th century. And the song, over the years, stayed alive and ended up in the United States and split into into at least two traditions. One was the direction that became the St. James, the song St. James Infirmary, and also Gambler's Blues, and the other one that became the Streets of Laredo. So you'll, if you listen to those songs, you'll see that there's a very similar structure of the songs. The Dying Crap Shooter's Blues uses that same structure, the same structure as the Gambler's Blues. What Mattel did was took this incident that apparently actually happened here on Cortland Street in downtown Atlanta and turned it into this terrific, hilarious song about a dying man's last request on his deathbed. So I decided to actually integrate that story, the story of the shooting of Jesse Williams, which is the person that Mattel names in the song, to integrate that into the story and actually have that be one of the two main plots that intertwine and that Joe Rose finds himself trying to unravel.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great. That's great. And you've had a long fascination with jazz and rhythm and blues.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of been your passion in your life, hasn't it?
Well, it's certainly been a part of my life, and it's been a part of my work. And and you're absolutely right that anything, everything that I write, there's a music element to it. Either there's actually a character that's a musician, or at the very least, there's a soundtrack sort of playing in the background. I'm a fan especially of music at the root, whether it be jazz or blues or rock and roll. And I find that as an American creation, to my mind, there's nothing that matches it. And it's been one of our most powerful, most significant, most effective exports. I mean, everybody around the world, no matter what else they think of us, loves American music. Going all the way back to, you know, the earliest blues, you can go anywhere in the world and you'll find fans. So I've always been a fan, and at one time was a semi-professional musician. But it does play a part, and will continue to play a part in everything that I write.
Mm-hmm. Good. And as you have to have good music in your life, and then you also need a beautiful woman. And
of course, yeah.
So Pearl Spencer.
The two do seem to go hand in hand.
Yeah, and the both the greatest things in life, and both can be the cause of greatest stress.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And Pearl Spencer is a great character. She kind of the mysterious beauty who Joe Rose can't stay away from. No man can stay away from. And she's really this exotic woman. And talk a little bit, if you would, about Pearl Spencer, because she's almost like a jazz song herself.
She is, and Pearl is the kind of character that I love to create because of all the things that you just said. She's this beautiful, exotic, somewhat dangerous femme fatale. At the same time, I worked hard on her because I don't want her to be, you know, a cutout or a cartoon character.
Right.
And she's very sexy. She's kind of crazy. She doesn't seem to want to pay attention to anyone, including Joe, and is very willing to walk on the wild side. At the same time, she's got her own vulnerabilities. As much as Joe is drawn to her, she's completely enamored with him. And as a matter of fact, he's the only man that she has any sort of loyalty to. And with Joe's in town, her life shifts into another, a completely different gear. And they sort of, the two of them can't get each other out of their minds. It's out of each other's lives. And that causes, in this particular book, that causes both of them problems. That her involvement with him and vice versa, it causes problems in both directions.
Mm-hmm. And David, it's The Dying Crap Shooter's Blues, which we're discussing today, published by Harcourt, it fits into the mystery genre, as your other novels do as well. And What was it, what is it now that the book is out and on the shelves and available online? What are you happiest about by taking a little break from Storyville and moving to Atlanta for a book? What are you happiest about?
You know, in order to keep Storyville fresh, I needed to take a break away from it. And, you know, from the time that I first dreamed up Valentin Sancerre and Storyville and the first pages of Chasing the Devil's Tail was in the mid-90s, early to mid-90s when I first began putting that together. And last year we talked about this. It took me a long time to write the first book. It took me a long time to get an agent, and then it took me a long time to get published. As soon as I did, there was one book on top of the next, three in a row. And so basically I had been living with these characters for 10 years. And so I needed to take a step away just to cleanse my palate. At the same time, I wanted to write this Atlanta book, and I want to continue to do books that use other settings. I mean, my plan right now, though these things change, is that I'm going to do these next two Storyville books, and then I've got other things I want to do in other places. Storyville is really the kind of place that I'm, you know, Valentin can't seem to turn his back on it, and neither can I. But having a break away from it I think it works best for both the Storyville books and the whatever the other one happens to be.
Mm-hmm. David, on a personal level, Katrina must have been devastating for you.
Well, it was devastating emotionally. What those people went through was beyond, you know, anything, since I didn't experience it. But, you know, everyone I knew in New Orleans, everyone that had ever experienced New Orleans was devastated by both the event itself and, of course, the aftermath. And when that happened, I heard from people around the world, and as a matter of fact, wrote an article for the Daily Paper for Milan, Italy, that because I have my first book was translated into Italian, and someone got in touch with me who said, would you write us a story about your reaction to what happened? And it really took me some time to get my thoughts together. And honestly, I'm still coming to terms with it as time goes on, and there's still these lingering problems. And of course, we've all heard about the crime that's been going on. I'm terribly afraid that just because of the combination of inaction or incompetence or whatever, that a great city is being allowed to die. I really do think that that New Orleans is still very much in peril, and I really hope, and every time I do an event or do an interview, I do bring this up, that everyone is cognizant of that you know, it's going to take some action and attention to save that city.
Yes, yes, I agree. I've had James Lee Burke on, and we talked mm-hmm. about that, and I did an interview with Linda Anderson about a rescue effort for the animals in New Orleans, and trying to keep a focus on New Orleans, because we can't act like because the Saints have won a couple of playoff games
that everything's all better now.
Yeah,
the city is in jeopardy, and it's going to take action, and it's going to take money to pull it out and save it. And we've got to save it. Without cities like New Orleans, it's just like taking one of the best features about who you are and just throwing it away. I mean, New Orleans is one of those special cities. And it's not just an American city. Around the world, people know New Orleans for the music, for the food, for the culture. There's just no other place like it in the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, David, what for when you were doing the research on Atlanta, what surprised you most about the city when you were reading the papers? One of the things kind of that grabbed me was it seemed like ecologically, that the city, like, it was a very dirty city.
Exactly. And actually, you hit on something right there. The two things, because living in Atlanta now, and people that have been here know that Atlanta tends to be a very sort of bright, shiny city. There's a lot of attention to the face of the city, and things are very, it's very modern, and the downtown is really, really clean, and it's got a lot of trees. It's a really pretty green city. And that's one of the things about writing the book that interested me and that people are reacting to is that Atlanta wasn't always like that. As a matter of fact, it was a very dirty, very corrupt, very crime-ridden, poverty, disease, really, you know, quite filthy city. And of course, because it was a railroad hub, there was apparently a cloud that hung over the city 24 hours a day. And the difference between the Atlanta of those times and the Atlanta now are remarkable. At the same time, it seems as what you get when you have a city like that that's got all that, those problems, you also get this very vibrant, dramatic, people clashing against each other, cultures clashing together, and you don't get that in modern Atlanta, but you did get it then, and that's where the drama comes from, and that's where these, you know, you can, that's how you can create really good stories, because of that very fact.
Well, David, I want to congratulate you on the Dying Crapshooter's Blues. I really enjoyed it. I think it's a book that people are going to enjoy reading. I was thinking I haven't read a lot of books that take place in Atlanta in this period of time. So I think that's one of the things I really enjoyed. So I'm glad you put your microscope on Atlanta for a book. And I'm also quite frankly glad to hear that Storyville's not something in the past with you.
Right. Yeah. Well, I was. You know, that's one of the things that about both Atlanta and Storyville, that Atlanta at this period of time was a very unique place, and it deserves attention. And I will tell you that even here in the city, because it is so spread out and so transient and mobile, people tend to not pay that much attention to Atlanta's history like they would in a city like New York or Philadelphia, one of the older cities that has this tradition. But Atlanta really does, even though it was destroyed, you know, laid to the ground about 150 years ago, it rose up, and it really did have a vibrant history. Same thing with Storyville. They're just these remarkable stages that are given to me as gifts, and I can, you know, put some characters out there and kind of send them on their way and get them into trouble and see what happens.
Great. Well, you've been listening to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. Our guest today has been David Fulmer. We've been discussing the Dying Crapshooter's Blues and also Rampart Street. And David, I look forward to catching up with you when the next book comes out.
I look forward to that too, Casey. Thanks again.
Thank you.